This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. On today's show, yesterday it was announced that an agreement has been reached with Iran regarding its nuclear program. Economic sanctions are going to be lifted. Iran made certain concessions on its nuclear activities. Now, this is a really huge moment for Iran, for the Middle East, and for the world. A lot of people are unpacking the details of what exactly was agreed to. There are people coming down on both sides of it, for and against it. They say this is a good deal, it's a bad deal. We're going to look at it from a unique perspective, and that is how this deal fulfills biblical prophecy. There are a number of ways that this is going to accelerate events in the Middle East and beyond, and things that align exactly with what we've been anticipating would happen based on the prophecies of the Bible. It's really important that we recognize just what a decisive moment in world events this really is. In our second story, how is Europe responding to the increasing dangers in the world? They've been talking for years about the need for a strong European military, a single powerful Euro army, but they've never been able to make much headway on that project because of all the divisions among all these European nations. But there are some recent events that have showed some nations taking matters into their own hands in order to safeguard themselves. And really, what they're doing might give us an idea of how Europe is going to confront the dangers of the 21st century. We're going to talk with trumpet writer Richard Palmer about this extremely important trend. Also in the program today, we're going to answer a question from a listener, and I'm going to finish off the show by talking about a lesson that I learned from my first triathlon. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. Yesterday, the big news emerged that the United States and other nations had struck a deal with Iran regarding its nuclear program. Now, fundamentally, this deal is a lifting of economic sanctions against Iran in exchange for certain concessions regarding its pursuit of nuclear technology. A lot of people are describing this as a historic deal. That is absolutely right. And I want to talk about a few reasons why it's so historic. This deal is setting the course for what happens in the Middle East for some time to come. And it's something that we are going to look back on as a decisive moment in world events. The most important effect of this deal is that it cements Iran's position as king of the Middle East. Now, this is something the Trumpet has been focusing on for over 20 years since 1994, pointing to Iran and pointing to its place within the Middle East and just how important it is from the standpoint of biblical prophecy. And probably nothing has highlighted this truth more than what just happened. Let's just look at some of the details of this deal and see how it cements Iran's position as king of the Middle East. After this deal was announced, Iran's president, Hassan Rouhani, said, "Negotiators have reached a good agreement, and I announce to our people that our prayers have come true." He's pretty pleased with this deal. Now, let's talk about some of the reasons why he might be so pleased. First of all, this deal puts Iran on the path to have economic sanctions lifted against the economic sanctions that have been against it, to have those lifted, and for Iran to take its place in the global economy, even while it keeps its nuclear program. The details of how these sanctions are going to be lifted have yet to be made public. But this agreement says that Iran can continue to develop and improve advanced centrifuge machines that can be used to fuel reactors or bombs. Now, you don't need advanced centrifuges for peaceful nuclear power generation. They're only essential if Iran wants to sprint for a nuclear bomb. This agreement doesn't even address Iran's intercontinental ballistic missile program, and that too, that's only useful if you want to deliver weapons of mass destruction. Intercontinental ballistic missiles. That means missiles that could reach America within 30 minutes, that are going to be shot across continents. Now, under this deal, for a while, Iran is not allowed to enrich uranium, but all of those restrictions go away after some years. Basically, the United States and these other nations are gambling on the hope that by that point, the Iranian regime will be so enmeshed in the global community that all these young people in Iran will have grown in political power and so on, that everything will be okay. That really is at the foundation of this deal. The idea that in the end, Iran belongs among the community of nations, that it should be a part of the global economy, that it can be trusted. President Obama said this deal is not built on trust. It's built on verification. Now, first of all, I don't know what makes him so confident in their verification ability, considering how many times Iran has deceived nuclear inspectors, time after time after time, where they have shown bad faith, where they've shown themselves determined to pursue nuclear technology regardless of what the international community says. And they do several things in clandestine fashion to try to evade inspectors and so on. But on top of that, this deal is ultimately based on trust. It's based on the notion that Iran is going to somehow transform into a force for stabilizing the Middle East. That's really what the ultimate hope is. There was that American diplomat who was involved in these negotiations for some time. He recently said Obama wants this deal as the centerpiece of his legacy, and he believes a peaceful Iran could be a bulwark against ISIS in the Middle East and the key to peace there. That's an extraordinary statement from that diplomat, and it has to be, I mean, it resonates because why else would they be making this deal unless they believed that about Iran? But the fact is, Iran has proven that it's not peaceful. It's the most destabilizing force in the Middle East, and it's been destabilizing that region. It's been supporting terrorist activities and other destabilizing activities even while it's been suffering under these sanctions, even while its economy has been pinched and while the people in Iran have been suffering because of the economic problems there as a result of these sanctions. Somehow the Iranian regime has managed to squeeze out the dollars it needs to continue to support terrorist activities in all of these surrounding nations. But now, with this agreement in place, that money is going to start to flow into Iran again. And just watch what happens. Watch what happens as that money starts flowing back into Iran. This deal, under this deal, supposedly sanctions will snap back if Iran violates the terms of the agreement. But I don't see any way that that's actually going to happen. A lot of analysts have noted that it took so much effort, just massive amount of work to get the world to agree to those sanctions in the first place. Can you really imagine? Can you see Russia and China reimposing those sanctions? Once those sanctions have been lifted, can you see them saying, yes, okay, we'll go back along with those, with all of this money flowing into Iran and everything that they've been doing to try to undermine those restrictions on Iran, even while they've been going on? And once Iran has the assets that have been seized, once those are released, once those sanctions start being lifted, once that money starts flowing back into Iran, watch what happens. First of all, that the economic hardship hasn't done a whole lot to keep Iran in line as it is, but without that economic threat, it's pretty well free to do what it wants. And really, the threat of sanctions snapping back, I don't think you can really view that as a credible threat. I don't think Iran would view that as a credible threat. So what is it going to do? What will Iran do? What sort of behavior are we going to see from Iran 6 months from now or a year from now? Again, this cements Iran's position as king of the Middle East. Everything that it has been doing to grab for that position over the last two decades, I think we're virtually guaranteed to see those activities ramp up. Just watch. What's going to happen in Afghanistan? What's going to happen in Iraq? Now, the Trumpet has drawn a lot of attention to those two theaters and just pointing to how much effort Iran has put into stirring up trouble there, spreading its influence through terrorism, making things difficult for coalition forces in those countries. And particularly with Iraq, we've been talking about how, for really since 1994, how Iran is going to virtually take over that country because of what biblical prophecy says. You can read about that in our booklet, The King of the South. You can see that. You can find that booklet on thetrumpet.com. We've been saying for years to watch Iraq and to watch for Iran taking over that country. Now, once it's freed up here in the time ahead, we are certain to see Iran work to lock down its assets in Iraq. Watch for that. What's going to happen with Saudi Arabia? What's going to happen with other Arab states in that region? They've been saying all along they are opposed to this deal. They're opposed to anything that's going to allow Iran to increase its hegemony and increase its power. We've been talking about how this is likely to set off an arms race throughout the Middle East. Watch for that. Watch for it. The Trumpet has been talking for years about an alliance among these nations that is prophesied in the Bible, and we've been seeing that alliance take shape as really an anti-Iran alliance. Well, what happens now that Iran's power grows even stronger? Watch those nations. Watch what happens among those nations. We've also talked quite a bit about Germany responding to Iran's rise, and how because of the United States appeasing Iran and really demonstrating a lot of weakness in its foreign policy in the Middle East, how Germany is positioning itself to confront Iran. Gerald Fleury had a really important story in the Trumpet a couple years back about Germany's whirlwind strategy against Iran and how you can see it positioning its assets, its military assets, in a way that is going to enable it to confront Iran. So what happens with Germany? Well, watch for that. Watch for Germany to get even more involved. Watch for it to get more involved with those anti-Iranian Arab nations, which that alliance, including Germany, that's another prophecy that we've talked quite a lot about over the years. Watch for that to take place. What's going to happen with the Islamic State? Obviously, there's been a lot of attention paid to this barbaric Islamist group lately. It's been doing a lot of dramatic things that get a lot of headlines and that stir up a lot of fear. Now, by comparison, Iran comes out looking like a moderate. It looks like quite a reasonable nation when you hold it up next to the Islamic State. And in a lot of ways, you know, Iran has used that as it's been pretty useful in just distracting the world's attention and getting it away from Iran. And here you've even had situations where you have Iran fighting on the same side as the U.S. and Western nations in fighting the Islamic State. But what's going to happen? What's going to happen when Iran is flush with cash and it's free to do as it pleases? Well, I think we could well see Iran rise up powerfully against the Islamic State and deal with it, and deal with it decisively, and show who really is boss in this region. What's going to happen with Israel? You know, since this deal has been announced, there's really been one nation that has stepped up and criticized it publicly. Benjamin Netanyahu came out immediately and just in very strong terms. He said, you know, the world is more dangerous today than it was yesterday. Now, there is this whole situation with Iran, all of these negotiations with Iran, and this whole deal that has been developing over the last 22 months has left Israel more vulnerable and more isolated than it has ever been. And really, this deal, the fact that it has now been cemented and that we are going to see Iran begin to increase its ties with other nations. We're going to see it rising economically once again. Well, that makes Israel's vulnerability far worse. And it makes Israel's isolation from other nations far worse. And that, too, is so significant, prophetically speaking. We've been talking about what happens when Israel just finds itself so isolated and so vulnerable. Well, the Bible is actually quite clear about the steps that we can expect Israel to take, and we need to watch for that. You can find information about that in our booklet, Jerusalem and Prophecy. Again, it's free. You can find that on thetrumpet.com under our in our literature library. Watch for what happens with Israel. Watch what happens when Iran gets a nuclear weapon. What's going to happen? This deal was supposed to prevent that. That was the whole promise of these negotiations from the very beginning. But this deal doesn't prevent an Iranian nuclear weapon. It guarantees a nuclear weapon. It's just a matter of time. And we've been talking for years about how the Bible says, when you look at the sequence of end time biblical prophecy, that it really is this strong Middle East power, a radicalized Islamic power that triggers World War III. And in passage after passage, in prophecy after prophecy, we see that World War III is going to be a nuclear war. Now, this is something that is not real to people in general. People don't consider the threat of nuclear war a serious threat. We've forgotten. It's been decades. It's been since World War II that a bomb was actually dropped on people. But we are going to see it again. The Bible prophesies that nuclear war is coming, that we're going to have cities without inhabitant, that the level of suffering and the scale of suffering is going to be unlike anything we have ever seen in history. It's going to be a nuclear war, and it's going to be this king of the Middle East that triggers it. Watch for it. Watch for it. President Obama and a lot of people are making glowing statements about how important this deal is, and they're talking about how this is going to guarantee peace and this is going to safeguard our future and so on. And the thing about all of those statements is time will tell. Time is going to tell, and it's going to tell very soon. It doesn't matter what they say. It doesn't matter how they believe this is going to unfold. History is going to play out, and very soon it will be clear to the whole world what has just happened. This really was a historic deal. This deal is setting the course for what's going to happen in the Middle East, really, from this point forward. And the whole world will be able to recognize just what a decisive moment in world events this really is. Visit thetrumpet.com. The top story right now we have on there regards this historic deal. It is called How the Iranian Nuclear Agreement Will Change History. Read it now on thetrumpet.com.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
There are some extraordinary things happening in Europe right now. The world is becoming more dangerous. Certain nations are getting bolder and more aggressive. And nations within Europe are recognizing they're not really ready to confront the threats of this emerging world disorder. There have been talk for years about the need for a strong European military, a single powerful Euro army. But there are so many competing interests in Europe. There's so much disunion in the European Union that not much headway has been made. So certain nations are taking matters into their own hands, and they might actually be pointing the way toward what we can expect to see in the future in terms of how Europe equips itself to defend itself and to confront the dangers of the 21st century. Trumpet writer Richard Palmer has written an article explaining some recent events that highlight this extremely important trend. I interviewed him via Skype in our office in the UK, and you're going to want to listen and take note of what he has to say here. In last week's Trumpet Weekly, there was this article from The Spectator about this new rapid reaction task force that Poland is looking to fulfill its security needs apart from NATO. Can you explain what Poland did here?
So Poland has a pretty big problem. It is a small country with a very large and pretty aggressive and militarily powerful neighbor, Russia. And so, if you're Poland, how do you defend yourself against Russia? Really, they know that they can't do that by themselves. They are pouring a lot of money into defense. They're putting together a pretty impressive tank fleet. But ultimately, they have no chance of surviving in a war with Russia.
And with Russia behaving the way that it is right now, this is a really important question on the mind of the Poles.
Exactly. And actually, a recent poll of Poles, if you pardon the pun, found that 70% of Poles believe that Russia is a major threat to them right now. So this is something that is very high on their minds. So what do? You need allies. And so Poland is a part of NATO, but Poland's problem is that NATO pretty much has zero bases, no infrastructure, nothing in Poland. And so they've got very little more than a piece of paper that says that their NATO allies will come and help them if they're attacked. And to make matters worse, you had last month, there was a poll, we talked about it on this program actually about a month ago, that came out that found that, for example, in Germany, the majority said that they should leave Poland high and dry if Russia happened to invade. So 58% said they should not come to the defense of a NATO ally if Russia invaded them. And only 38% said that they should. And it wasn't just Germany. Italy, 51% said, no, we shouldn't come to the defense of an ally. France, 53%. So Poland relies for its existence on allies that it cannot trust to defend it. So what's your solution? They know that they can't rely on themselves for defense. So almost counterintuitively, Poland's only option is to hug those allies more tightly.
Let me just interrupt for a moment and pardon my ignorance, but just before we leave the point about NATO, hasn't NATO showed itself to be unreliable anyway? With some of those nations that are part of that alliance that have faced threats very recently, NATO hasn't come through for them.
Right. Now, there's not been an outright attack on a NATO member, but there are things that have... Russia has slowly built in that direction. So you had Georgia quite a while ago now, which was not part of NATO, but it was leaning in that direction. Russia invaded and NATO did absolutely nothing. Then Ukraine was the next step up. So Ukraine, America, France and Britain all signed a piece of paper. And that's the top three military powers of NATO right there. And those three signed a piece of paper telling Ukraine, we promise if you hand over your nuclear weapons, we promise that we will defend you if Russia invades. Russia invaded, the US, Britain, France did nothing. And so this same poll last month found the majority of Poles do not believe America will come to their aid if they are attacked.
Not an irrational belief.
Exactly. Only 49% said that they believed America would come to their aid.
So what you said is their alternative, since we don't believe NATO is going to defend us, we need to go after specific members of this alliance and to draw them more close to ourselves, kind of outside of their NATO obligation specifically.
Well, inside or outside, as long as they are involved within Poland, basically to hug these other nations so tightly that Russia cannot attack Poland without attacking these allies too. Mm-hmm. And so they're pursuing that in quite a few different ways. They'll do it within NATO, but they don't want to, this is about their security. So they do not want to put all their eggs in one basket. So they'll do it inside NATO. They'll do it outside NATO. They'll use the European Union. They'll do it bilaterally just with Germany. They'll do it among other countries in Eastern Europe that are threatened. So you have the Visegrad Group, for example, is an emerging group of nations like Poland and other like-minded countries that have a fear of Russia that are developing some mutual defense capabilities.
With that in as the background, this story that came out in The Spectator, what's happening right now, this very high readiness joint task force, what is it that Poland did specifically?
Well, this is something, and again, when we say Poland, I just want to make clear, we're talking about pretty much all of Central and Eastern Europe. Poland is just a good example. Poland hosted military exercises last month with the very high readiness joint task force. And at the moment, in its current stage, this joint task force is essentially a rebranding of the German-Dutch Corps. They wanted to put it together quickly. The German-Dutch Corps was already there as a multinational force, already available to deploy quickly. And so they invited them in, and they held military exercises in Poland. And it was the first exercises of this task force. And really, when you look at it from a historical perspective, if you travel back in time 60 years and told someone that the Poles would invite in a multinational blitzkrieg unit with a German in charge, and they'd invite them in to come in and do exercises in Poland, they'd think you were crazy. But that's exactly what we're seeing right now. And so the idea behind this task force is that it will rotate, that it will spend a bit of time in each country. And other countries in Eastern Europe are also getting temporary, quote-unquote, NATO positions in their country. And they're there to act as basically a tripwire so that Russia can't invade without attacking these forces too.
Just to talk about this this joint German-Dutch task force for a moment, we've talked about this as being an example of how Germany is essentially creating something akin to a European army led by Germany without it being like a Europe-wide army, making these bilateral agreements with the militaries of other European nations in order to accomplish something where it's amplifying its own military power without having to go through the European Parliament and that type of thing.
Exactly, because they've just found themselves basically repeatedly bashing their heads against the wall, trying to get all the very different 27, 28 member states to come together and form an army. It's a big process. You get Britain that just doesn't want to be a part of it, that keeps blocking it, and it's dragged out way longer than they've wanted. So they essentially sat down and said, well, let's just do this much simply. We'll work with one nation at a time. You know, we'll bring in other nations, and we'll work on it at a one nation at a time basis. And the length that they've gone to with the Netherlands especially is absolutely incredible. You're starting to reach the point now that a very significant part, if not most, of the offensive capacity of the Dutch army is now on the way to being a combined Dutch-German initiative.
And if you have a combination of Germany and the Netherlands, you know who's in charge.
The German constitution even helps this, where if European Union military forces deploy anywhere, the only parliament that has to vote on that is Germany's. And you would have very easily a similar situation in the Netherlands. But it is mind-boggling how close these two armies are coming together. And then Poland is working along the same lines. And they've actually said, well, we want to imitate the Dutch-German brigades are doing. They also are working together in naval cooperation as well. So we're seeing that this is an alternative to NATO. In a lot of ways, NATO is about trusting America. And Poland doesn't want to put all their eggs in that basket, so they're also forming these close relationships with Germany.
And it really is Germany that would be the main ally that they're trying to court this way, this German-Netherlands Corps. It's a well-established military force that it's ready to deploy within 20 to 30 days. It's proven itself very capable. Poland is looking at this and saying, this is firepower that we'd like to have behind us. We'd like to have them to support us. But it's really the Germans that they're most concerned about getting behind them and being able to defend them.
Yes, exactly. The there's no comparison between the German army and the Dutch army. The German army is much bigger, and the German army is much closer. So from Poland's point of view, yeah, Germany is definitely the important partner there.
So the main point that you are making in this, as you're evaluating what's going on here, is you're saying that the weakness of NATO, the fact that NATO really can't be trusted, and that the Poles are looking at that alliance as, you know, it only goes so far. We need more assurance for our own security. That weakness of NATO is actually sort of setting the foundation for what will be a stronger European military.
Yes, that is exactly it. If everybody trusted NATO guarantees, then it would be this European army would be a much more distant project, because there'd be no need for it. Why would Poland want foreign troops on their soil if they believe they could really trust these troops to back up the agreement that they've signed? So it is somewhat a counterintuitive idea. You know, European cooperation isn't working, therefore we'll see more European cooperation. But it is exactly where Poland is going with this, and at the rest of Eastern Europe. And again, it's important to remember they're doing exactly the same. All these other nations are doing exactly the same thing.
Well, in a sense, it makes sense that you would look at, say, a one-on-one type of agreement, or in this case, a one-on-two agreement, one nation with two other nations, and kind of dealing face-to-face a little bit more, that they would be more comfortable with that arrangement than dealing with this monolithic, multifaceted, fractious entity of the European Union or NATO, where there's a lot of nations involved, and there might be competing interests, and they might not be able to accomplish what they want to. In a sense, you can see why Poland would go down that road. In one sense,
yes, exactly. And just because they are going down this road, of course, doesn't mean they've given up on a European army. This idea of bilateral cooperation is a means to that end. And even the former German defense minister, Thomas de Maizière, he spelt out this policy probably more explicitly than anyone. And the idea is you do deals with one nation, then you do deals with another and another and another. And pretty soon you have a critical mass. You're dealing with 5, 6, 7 nations, and you can start bringing them all together into a European army. And of course, one thing we've talked about recently with the euro crisis is that this European structure is unwieldy. It's not able to cope with the euro crisis. It's not able to cope in exactly the same fashion militarily. And so what we're going to do is we're going to see a pared down unit, much smaller, much more like-minded, and therefore much quicker to work together. And once that happens, and you've already got all of these bilateral agreements in place, you've already got the German army used to fighting alongside the Dutch army. They've overcome all of the obstacles that come from different languages, different standards of training. All of those have been sorted out already. And they've done this with the Poles. They've done this with the Danes or whoever else. Then you can see this European army coming together very, very quickly once that grouping pairs down to a manageable size.
So many aspects of this story that back up points that we've been making for years of the things that we expect to see within Europe. You look at the fact that it's Germany that's really driving this, that's kind of laying the groundwork for what we can expect to see as a developing European army. The fact that the Poles are approaching Germany with this kind of trust, if you will, given their history. The fact that it's Russian aggression that's really creating this kind of fear-driven military policy that Poland and Germany are pursuing, all very important factors, prophetically speaking.
Yes, exactly. The one that stands out to me the most, I think, is the fact that it's Germany driving this. Because just take it from a purely looking at Europe point of view. So why would Germany be the driving force behind putting together a European army? Surely it would make equal sense for it to be France to be the one that's going to, say, Belgium and coming to a deal, and then going to Spain and coming to a deal. But it's not. It's not France. It's not Italy. It's not Spain. It is Germany. And it's not just us at the Trumpet that are pointing to that. There have been a lot of stories over the past couple of years from anywhere from just the mainstream mass media to defense analysts, pointing to the fact that it is Germany leading the way here. And apart from the prophetic and the historic background that we talk about here on the trumpet, I can't see any other logical reason for Germany to be the one in the driving seat.
Well, thank you, Richard. The title of the article, NATO's Weakness Will Make Europe Stronger. You can find that on thetrumpet.com. Watch for it. Thank you, Richard, for your time.
Thank you. Good to be here.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It's time for Q&A. Here we are again. I have our social media manager, David V. Hill, with me.
Great to be here.
David likes to collect questions from listeners. We don't get a whole lot. We need more, don't we, David?
Yes. I feel like our audience is not taking advantage of the service that we provide here. I mean,
well,
wow.
Yeah. Send us your questions. You just send us your questions by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. But we do have a question for this program. Lay it on me, David.
This question comes from Nick. He says, the quote, "go to college is to education, what put stuff in your mouth is to nutrition," deeply captivated my attention during last week's segment of the Trumpet Hour. May I ask for an insightful meaning behind this quote?
Okay, so the quote, read the quote again.
He said, "go to college is to education, what put stuff in your mouth is to nutrition."
I love this quote. David Burge, I really like David Burge. He's a very witty analyst.
He's got the same first name as me, too.
So, put stuff in your mouth is to nutrition. Put stuff in your mouth. That is, you know, it could be anything. Nachos, Cheese Whiz. What do people put in their mouths?
Big Macs.
Cupcakes. Whatever tastes good, whatever pleases the palate, just shove it in there. It has absolutely no relation to quality. It has no relation to, you know, what it's going to do to your body. No concern with what's proper proportions or anything like that. What's going to fuel the body for good health. So it's concern for nutrition that motivates you to put things in your mouth like kale, right? Or Brussels sprouts.
Yes.
Or asparagus. You know, you're not necessarily going to be like, you know, I'm just craving I'm craving beet greens. I don't know, maybe some people do. But if you do those things, you know, if you eat those things, you're going to feel better, and you know you're more concerned about the quality of what's going into your body and how you're fueling your body. So that's the one side of the equation. David Burge is saying that go to college is the educational equivalent of just saying shove stuff in your mouth, right? It's the McDonald's Big Mac of the mind. Just go to college. Rather than looking at the quality of the education that you're getting in that college. You know, obviously there's a good education can be found out there, but there is a whole lot of nonsense going on in colleges today. And there are people that are spending tens of thousands of dollars a year in order to have that nonsense shoved at them.
Yeah, I feel like too, today's message is so focused on earnings power. You know, go to college, it maximizes your earnings power. But there's really no thought of, you know, like, well, what are the correct goals for you? Where do you want to take your life? And does that always align with making the most money?
Yeah, well, that's true. I imagine there's a segment of people that go to college where, you know, they're actually going to increase their earning power. But what about the people that are going to college to study minority studies or feminist studies, or what are those people? How do those people earn more money for pursuing those things? And how many people who go with these really soft majors in sociology fields or soft sciences, what do they do? They end up graduating college with $80,000 in debt and getting a waitressing job somewhere.
or government work.
Okay, so hopefully that explains what that quote was saying. I hope David Burge would agree with me.
Thank you, Nick, for your question.
Again, you can send us your questions at letters@thetrumpet.com. Just email us there. David, what do you think?
I think you can also leave some comments on Facebook or Google Plus. We're mining that as well.
Way to go, David. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
It's time for today's last word.
The first time I participated in a formal race, it was a short triathlon. It was called the Super Sprint Distance, quarter mile swim, 11 mile bike, 2 mile run. That was plenty for me, especially because of my mediocrity at swimming. In the weeks beforehand, I trained consistently, but even as my biking and running speed and endurance improved, swimming got no easier whatsoever. Nevertheless, I set an ambitious yet realistic goal to complete the race in 1 hour. The day of the event was exciting. The atmosphere hummed with energy in the pre-dawn darkness as we collected our racing timers and set up our gear. Good-humored conversation with fellow triathletes was easy. Veterans were quick to offer advice and assistance to a newbie. My bike's tires had been low on air for some time, and I borrowed a super fancy high-tech pump from a helpful stranger. A built-in gauge enabled me to inflate the tires to precisely their prescribed air pressure, making them firmer and more beautiful than ever. "Thanks, this is going to shave 10 minutes off my time," I said. It was a joke, but I was genuinely excited to cruise on my new wheels. Little did I know. Then the race began as I plunged into the murky lake water and began swimming amid a blur of windmilling limbs. I remembered to pace myself. Smooth and steady. Breathe easy. You're a torpedo. Reaching the first of three buoys we had to circle around, my thoughts had begun to diversify. Don't stop. Survive the swim and you can move on with your life. I'm pretty sure this buoy is drifting further from shore. By the time I had rounded the last marker, in order to stave off exhaustion, I was erratically employing a series of about five different swimming strokes, two of which I'm pretty sure I had spontaneously invented. Why is the beach not getting any closer? Am I moving? Is that my grandma passing me? I had hoped to complete the swim in 10 minutes. After nearly 22 minutes that felt like 45, at long last, I felt terra firma under my feet and could run up onto the beach. A cheering crowd lined the path. There was my family, all smiles, shouting and waving their arms as I ran past. "Way to go, sweetheart! Go, Daddy!" Wow, suddenly I was Iron Man. A surge of warm energy flooded my body. I hustled through the bicycle transition and hit the road. Far more comfortable territory for me. I pushed as hard as I could. Go, go, go. Wow, beautiful day. What a cool thing to be doing on a Sunday morning with all these people. As I pedaled, I saw the leg markings on all the riders. Organizers had written our racing numbers and our ages on our right calf muscles. I couldn't help but notice as we gently jockeyed for position, what a diverse group. Kids, students, parents, grandparents, all in the same race. Wow, I just got passed by a 62-year-old woman who's in better shape than I am. The miles clicked by. I passed the halfway point. I felt terrific. Sunshine filled the cloudless sky of a perfect morning. Invigorating. I was picking up speed, gaining momentum. Then my back tire blew out. For a moment, I didn't want to believe it. I continued to pedal as if I could finish the course on a flat. Within 5 short seconds, though, it was completely deflated and the back end of my bike began to wobble. I hopped off the bike and began running with it, my mind racing. I hadn't planned for this. Apparently, my old tire wasn't accustomed to optimal air pressure. I kept running. How far did I have to go? Maybe 3.5 miles, maybe 4? After that would be the actual 2-mile run. I had to go for it. "Hey, way to go. Hang in there." a word of encouragement from a passing cyclist. My pace quickened a little. After nearly a mile, I came to a policeman who was directing traffic. "You gonna run with that all the way back?" he asked. "Unless you want to take it for me," I said. "I'll be here for a while," he smiled. "Thanks," I said, leaning my bike against a guardrail on the roadside. I grabbed my water bottle from my bike and took off. "Good luck," I heard the officer say behind me. Cyclists passed me at a regular clip. Every third or fourth of them would pitch out some support. "Keep it up. Good job." My bike was wounded. My time goal was trashed. And I could not get the smile off my face. There's nothing else I'd rather be doing right now than this. The encouragement of the other racers was wind in my sails. I suspect the Apostle Paul ran a few foot races in his day. He had felt the surge of energy from spectators cheering him on as he ran. He likened those witnesses to the spiritual giants of history who have completed their spiritual endurance race and whose memory now inspires us to press forward in ours. He wrote in Hebrews 12, "Wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which does so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God." What a picture. This great and royal congregation is full of spiritual athletes, past and present, who have driven themselves through extreme obstacles and persisted toward the finish. Abraham, Moses, David, Jeremiah, Ezra, Peter, Paul, John, these luminaries are in spirit witnesses urging us onward. Alongside them are those still pressing forward with us, shoulder to shoulder. Paul told us to run spiritually with the urgency of one striving for first place, a prize only one person can receive. In truth, though, in this race, the crown of righteousness isn't given to only one victor, but unto all them also that love his appearing, it says in 2 Timothy 4, all those who finish the course and keep the faith. My triathlon ended up taking much longer than I expected. After my truncated bike leg, I ended up running about a 10K. It was longer than I'd run since college, but it was far faster than I would have expected, particularly after a death swim and a brisk bike. I felt absolutely jubilant as I ran through the finish line a glorious 45 minutes later than I expected to, and into the arms of my family. In no small part, I give credit to the restorative encouragement I received from a cloud of witnesses. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of another Trumpet Hour. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to read the stories that we talked about on the program today. You can even get a free subscription to our monthly news magazine, The Philadelphia Trumpet. Send us your thoughts or your questions by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. You can follow us on Twitter @thetrumpet_com. Find us on Facebook or Google Plus just by searching The Philadelphia Trumpet. I want to thank my guest today, Richard Palmer, and thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from F.P. Jones. Experience is that marvelous thing that enables you to recognize a mistake when you make it again. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice, 101.3 KPCG, and on the web at kpcg.fm.